in our improv spaces, we do, you know, people are able to recognize those moments of anxiety, those moments of hard, those moments of tough, but we don't want to give that more weight than the moments of positivity, of joy, of laughter, because those are the moments we want more of.
Welcome to the Living Transplant Podcast, where we take you behind the scenes of the transplant program at Toronto General Hospital. I'm your host, Candace. Each episode, we share the powerful stories of transplant recipients and living donors, along with insights and education from leading medical professionals. Today, I'm asking the question, what if laughter could be a form of therapy? In this episode, I sat down with Itzi Gao, a drama therapist, actor, and York University alum who uses improv and comedy to help people navigate anxiety and find light in dark places. Itzi shares how stepping into play, vulnerability, and even failure can become powerful tools for healing. From reframing our fear through humor to rediscovering joy in the unknown, this conversation explores how the art of yes and can transform the way we relate to ourselves and the world around us. Because sometimes the best way through dark times is to laugh your way towards the light. Please enjoy. Welcome back to the Living Transplant Podcast. It's my great pleasure to have Itzi Gao here in the studio. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
So I'm going to jump right in because I have so many questions for you. But we're going to start at the beginning. So what inspired you to think about improv and drama therapy as a way to help people manage and deal with anxiety?
I guess the thing that really pushed me towards it was my own experience with it. Like, I started taking improv classes because I had such intense social anxiety, and I'd say general anxiety as well. I was never diagnosed with it, but I would take like psychology classes in university, and my psychology professors would like call me over and be like, "Oh, you seem to be having a hard time speaking in class," or like, you know, being comfortable in group work. And I was like, oh, it's very nice that they notice that. So I started taking improv classes to help myself. And I noticed such a large shift in myself. It helped me so much that at a certain point, I wanted to learn more about why it worked and how it worked. So I went and I got my drama therapy degree. At that point, I was already doing improv regularly. And to me, the way that improv helped my anxiety and the way drama therapy helped me understand why it had helped me and how it had helped me was something that really pushed me to want to work in that space and want to see that effect on other people as well.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because, you know, I love improv. I've done it since high school, and then I got back into it right before COVID. For a lot of people, when I would talk to them, they would be like, "That's terrifying. Why would you ever do improv? That seems like the most terrifying thing you could ever do." And so when I think about it, I'm like, okay, so improv is terrifying for anyone. And then you add a layer of people who are dealing with anxiety, you know, how do those two things come together? And, you know, how do you create a space where people who have anxiety are then going into something that seems terrifying anyways?
Yeah, I'm always so impressed that people are there that first week.
Yes.
And I always tell them, like, I'm not going to take it for granted. Like, I know that everybody's instinct right now might be to be like, I'll give it a few minutes. And if I need to leave, I'll leave. You know, I'll pretend to go to the bathroom and I'll just run for it.
Yes, just run.
And I'm always come back from like the first break that we have to going like, I'm never sure that everyone's going to return. And it's like, you know, I just want everyone to feel like that the tough part was signing up for it. The tough part was getting to that spot. But once they get to that spot, to feel as comfortable and at home as possible. And that is like the intent at the beginning, as much as possible, to create that space where people will feel okay. And there's a few ways that we try to do it. One is like with intention and acknowledgement, to sit there and be like, we all signed up for a class to help us with our anxiety, to grow in a certain way. And you can look to your left and look to your right and know that in this room, everyone understands and everyone, nobody's going to judge you on what you're saying. They're just going to be so impressed you're saying something. And there's a comfort in being able to know that you're in that space. I'll never ask somebody to just like be creative, be funny. Like that's not the the way it works.
Yes.
I'm always starting off with things that like people have concrete answers to, or like they know the answers to. So even just like saying your name, you know your name, saying it out loud, everyone repeating it back to you, things like that, where it's an odd thing, but our brains love a correct answer. And so much of improv and so much of life is, you know, there's no one correct thing to say. You're not being marked. It's just whatever you put out there is going to be great. It's going to be fine. But we don't start there. We start with concrete. What's your name? Say your name out loud. Everyone responds with your name back to you. We even do like high five games and stuff like that, just so you're aware you're building this space with other people. But you're never put directly in a situation where you don't know what you're about to do. We'll slowly build into those spaces where it may not be under your control to be an incredibly perfect human being at all times. You might make a mistake. You might say something that, you know, you weren't prepared to say, but we'll only do that once we have the container in the group.
I love that. Yeah. Because I think for me too, you know, a lot of our anxiety comes from that. I have to say the right thing. Who are the people in the room who are going to be judging me? How do I make sure that I put my best face forward, or everything should be exactly in the right space? And thinking about improv, like it's so messy and so crazy and silly and chaotic. And, you know, that place where you can just let go. You know, it's interesting to hear that you take those teeny tiny baby steps to get people to where they can even try to think about being imperfect, like starting with those little pieces, like their name. It's amazing.
Yeah. We play a game that's a three-part game to move from like correct answer to no correct answer. Mm-hmm. And one is just walking around a room and pointing at things and naming what they are. Mm-hmm. Just anything in your room. You point at a TV, it's a TV. Just say out loud, TV, coffee, whatever it is. And everyone feels very comfortable because they know the name of things.
Right. Yeah. You know what a wall looks like or a coffee cup looks like. Yeah.
And then we do a second version of it, which I tell everyone to point at the ceiling in silence. And the next thing that they point at, they're going to call the ceiling. And every time they point at something new, they call it what they previously pointed at. So there's like a little bit, everyone moves a little slower in the room, but they're searching for the correct answer, but it's still able to be got. They get they get to that point. And then the third version of the game is point at things and name it anything but what it is. And then I find oftentimes in my anxiety classes, I find people after like saying 7 or 8 words frozen. They're pointing at a chair. They can't walk past it because they still haven't said a name for it, but their brain is just not allowing them to come up with a word for the chair.
Interesting.
And we talk afterwards about it. And I'm like, we all know words. We all know things. We proved it in the first round and second round. Like, what makes the third one so hard? The issue becomes that when we don't have when every answer is a correct answer, our brain starts judging our answers. Is this one more correct or less correct? So if I say apple, and then I say pear, my brain starts going, this next one can't be a plum. I need to like push out of this category because plum is a worse answer now than this. And like we start creating this spectrum of good and bad answers. And people, once they hear that voice in their head of going like it needs to be good, that's when it's so hard to come up with the next thing. Our self-judgment keeps us from being creative, because we need it to be good for it to surface in our brain. So we talk about it afterwards and go like, there's no repercussions, right? You don't win anything, you don't lose anything, but still our brain loves the idea of more correct. I can do better. And that stops us from doing things.
That's fascinating. And, you know, you talk a little bit about that, like purposefully failing at things. Like we're making sure we're doing the wrong thing or saying the wrong thing to kind of change that brain frequency. And, you know, we talk a lot about vulnerability in theater, in, you know, acting and therapy, obviously therapy. When you combine all of that, how do you find people changing from like that spectrum of like the first couple experiences that they have in trying to fail versus, you know, maybe at that 6 week mark when they've been practicing this whole time through your classes? Like how do people, do they have a light switch that goes off and all of a sudden it works? Does it take, you know, a long time to practice that?
You know, it takes time in the room, but not a huge amount of time because of the feedback loop in the room. So when people make mistakes, the positive feedback that they get in the room and the joy that it brings the room really changes the way that they interact with mistakes. I always say at the beginning that, and it's for me as well, that my brain has a hard time diagnosing a situation of whether the failure is going to be like, I'm going to be punished, it's going to be painful, whatever it is, versus a failure that's going to bring joy and laughter to the room. I always tell my students that, like, we're going to be practicing failure, mistakes and things like that. But when you leave the studio, when you leave the space and you're walking home and you're crossing the street, not a time for failure,
right?
Not a time for mistake. Right. Don't play with oncoming traffic. Don't, you know, that's not the moment.
Right.
But the issue is, our brains are trained that every moment is like crossing the street. And I need to practice to be able to differentiate that not every failure is life and death. There's a very simple game that I really enjoy playing with students, which is they just count to three back and forth. So one person says one, their partner says two, and then they say three. Then their partner says one, they say two, their partner says three. And they just go on like that. And then I pause it and I say, we're going to replace the number two with a clap. So it goes one, then the other person claps, the first person says three, then the other person says one, the first person claps, the other, and they go back and forth. And it's very simple instructions, but it's so hard to do. So people are clapping while saying three, they're unable to say the number, like it just becomes, it's a very hard thing for our brain to switch from the number counting to the physical. But there's so much joy in the room and laughter. And I always have to tell everyone afterwards that notice that when you made a mistake, your partner didn't look for a new partner. They don't stop the game. They just continue playing. And we bring this joy and laughter to the room. And perfection would have no laughter. It would be very impressive, but there would be no joy. Nobody would be laughing together about how good they are at playing the game.
Right, right.
I have a thing where my body, like I'll physically guard my vitals with my arms and hands, like I'm protecting myself. And I do it in social situations. And I was told by a psychology professor that my brain is misdiagnosing physical and emotional danger. And even though I'm walking into a room, my body is reacting like I'm under attack and is protecting myself. And it's just because our brains have, it's, you know, it's new, this whole social world and this whole social danger, and my body just reverts back to I'm under physical danger, and my body reacts in that way.
Interesting. Yeah, I noticed when you said that, when you were talking previously as well, like disconnecting those things, like when people have anxiety, it's the same thing. You know, I have a couple people who in my life who deal with anxiety on a daily basis. And, you know, for some people going to the grocery store, you just go, you just get in your car. And, you know, for other people, that is a monumental task to all of the tiny steps that you have to do to get into that grocery store and then buy your groceries and pay and get home. Like that is a mountain. And, you know, I think often we think about dealing with these types of situations. We think about anxiety or depression and the ways to help ourselves with that in a really serious way, right? Like we think, okay, we're going to sit down in a very traditional therapy chair. It's all going to be serious. Like that's the only way to heal. And so when I think about this, you know, improv for anxiety, I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about that opposite, right? Like you talked about laughter and mistakes. Like how does bringing laughter into that healing change how people react? And, you know, how do you use that not serious way of healing to help people?
Yeah, I think I'm also one of those people that I have to keep fighting the idea in myself that it needs to hurt for it to be doing something. I'm the type of person that, like, if I'm going to get like massage therapy or something, if I'm not feeling pain while it's happening, I feel like it must not be doing something.
Interesting. Yeah.
And my brain really would connect the idea of like growth and hardship, growth and
right
pain, growth and all of these things. When in reality, growth and joy also go together. Growth and fun, growth and laughter. I think we give the hard parts and the pain a lot of credit and a lot of acknowledgement and recognition. And when good things and fun things and like joyful things happen, we move on very quickly. We almost go like, well, that was a good moment and moving on. Instead of sitting there and acknowledging and like recognizing this positive moment that you've had and how we can grow and learn from that as well. I forget the psychologist. There's a psychologist that kind tried to coin the phrase positrum as like a positive trauma, moment of joy that has given somebody has pushed somebody into being the person they are, instead of just seeing the negative traumas as the things that push us. But in it really does, for me, in the room, I can see it happening when we have these joyful moments and we actually sit down and unpack them, when we sit there and we truly give recognition for this moment of positivity that somebody had in the room where they showed something, where they did something, and it caused laughter in the room. And most people in that moment feel uncomfortable acknowledging their win, acknowledging their positive moment. And to be able to like gift that to somebody so that they can grow. In psychology, there's also like a lot about, is just removing the symptoms, what are you left with? Like medication and all of these things can help so much, but we also need to build the positive inside. There's in improv, there are like the rules of improv. Don't say no, don't block someone. And there's one improv theorist that says, instead of focusing on all of these rules, don't do this, don't do this, why don't we find the fun, the joy that is a positive moment in a scene and say, do more of that. And all of the other stuff will fall away because we're growing the positive.
I love that.
And in our improv spaces, we do, you know, people are able to recognize those moments of anxiety, those moments of hard, those moments of tough, but we don't want to give that more weight than the moments of positivity, of joy, of laughter, because those are the moments we want more of. So we need to be able to look at them and recognize them, acknowledge them. And we play, this is like an end of the term game because I know it stresses a lot of people out, but we play compliment games at the end where people will compliment other people and about what they've seen in the room, in the space, what they've brought into the improv that we've done. And people have a very hard time accepting their compliments. There's a lot of deflection. And I always have to tell people, and it's the same for me, like, you can just say thank you. So I say, like, I understand you have an impression of yourself and you know yourself so well. But when somebody's complimenting you, I need you to listen to them and go, I can learn a little bit of my positive. Like, I can learn a little bit about my my positive traits from believing this person and knowing that like they see me as well, even if that's not the way I see me, so that we can have those joyful moments and that laughter can mean something for growth.
That's amazing. I mean, people listening may be thinking, you know, why are you talking to Yitzi today about improv on a transplant podcast? And, you know, for me, as a dialysis patient, I often found that when I was my funniest would also sometimes be my darkest moments, right? When I went to comedy because I thought, you know, this is a coping mechanism that is you know, it clicks with my heart. When I am in my darkest times, comedy helps pull me out of it, right? It really helps me. And, you know, we can get comedy from that darkness. Often laughter comes from that darkness. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that. Like, how have you seen humor help people process the traumas they've had or the fears they might have, whether it's anxiety or, you know, other things that they're going through, in a healthy way, and not just kind of distracting ourselves with comedy, but really using comedy and laughter to help us heal?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things about humor that really help people in those moments. One is that laughter provides distance. To find the jokes and to find the funny and to find the laughter, we cannot only be within the feelings. We need to be able to see the situation, to see the full situation, to have a little bit of distance from the flooding of feelings that oftentimes come with the hard moments. Mm-hmm. And that those jokes and that laughter really allow that distance and to be able to, I mean, it's so much comedy comes from darkness as well. Like, those are the moments of life. We talk about laughter in class because I don't want people to feel like they have to make jokes. So we talk about laughter comes from recognition. I feel like stand up nowadays, people come up and they say, like, I noticed this about the world, and we laugh because we also notice that about the world.
Right.
And if we start saying that laughter and joy has nothing to do with the darkness or the hardship, we're missing an enormous amount of that recognition that every single person in life has. And to be able to find the joy allows you to share that hardship with somebody else and to know that there is recognition there. The laughter and the jokes connects people. It allows people to go, I see what you're going through. I recognize it. Everybody is going through something. Everyone has felt pain. Everyone has felt, oftentimes to different varying degrees, but it's not unrecognizable. And when laughter comes from recognition and somebody is able to find that laughter and jokes, it really does connect them to the people around them and bring that ability to, like, share that moment and to know that they're not alone, that there's another person there. But it's also the recognition, the idea of, like, I can share this in a way that I know I can see somebody else going, oh, I can see what you see. I can laugh with you. I can provide this humor that's going to allow another person to recognize it.
That's amazing. You've done a bunch of improv for anxiety classes. I'm wondering what kinds of transformations you've seen in people who engage in your classes, and are there any moments that have really stuck with you over, you know, the time that you've done this?
For me, often, like, I can see it most in myself because of that vantage point of when I started improv, I needed to be, like, pushed to go by family and people who knew that it would be a good thing for me. But I would hide in my car during breaks. I would, like, make sure that I would leave the room and have somewhere to go that I could be by myself because I couldn't be around others. I also, like, I thought any wrong word, any wrong sentence, I was going to just lose every friend I had in life. Like, I was always living on that space of, I needed to be perfect, otherwise, you know, catastrophe would occur. For me, that freedom, that ability to be myself in situations, I see it in, you know, my students, the people in the workshops. I can see them getting to the place where, instead of thinking what is, like, the right thing to say here, they start thinking of, like, what of themselves they can put forward. With anxiety, so many people are in fight, flight, freeze constantly, that their body, it's taking a toll on their body. And you can see people loosen that a little bit, let go of it a little bit. We talk a lot about in improv that it's not about finding the funny or the right thing to say. It's about bringing as much of yourself to a moment, and you have access to all the correct things to say because it's all in you. It's your experiences. I always have to tell people that, like, they are the funniest part and most interesting part of any conversation. No fact, no nothing like that. It's just their experience. You know, there's no fact about coffee that's going to be more interesting than you describing the first time you tasted it and what it, your experience of it. So instead of searching for the right and correct thing to say, just bring more of yourself to those moments and you'll have enough to say. And we play games that are especially like focused on bringing presence to a moment. It's not your responsibility to make this game go well or be perfect, just enough to allow the other person to bring themselves to that moment and be able to access that. And it really does. You see people let go of searching for the right and the correct and just being okay being.
Just being. I love that. I watch a lot of Drag Race. It brings me a lot of joy. For people who don't know what that is, it's a reality television series about drag queens. And one thing that I hold so close to myself is, and I don't remember who said it, but on the show, somebody said, be yourself to free yourself. And I think it's sometimes hard to remember because we do think about all of the structures that are put in place and all the perfect things we should be doing and how we should look and what we should say. And, you know, sometimes I just think if I let go of all of that, I'm going to have such a better time in my day-to-day life and definitely in those experiences with other people instead of trying to impress them, just be with them.
One of the things I learned early in improv was watching a scene and it was like two people lifting weights and they were just lifting heavier and heavier weights. And I remember watching it and going like, nobody in the audience is sitting there going like, I really see myself in these huge, but like, as soon as one person lets a vulnerability out or lets something that's less than strength, people in the audience lean forward and go like, oh, that I can connect to. Like, it is the small vulnerable details that bring another person to you and be able to connect. If it's just our strengths, I mean, strengths are human, but not as human as vulnerabilities. So to be able to connect, we need to be able to share in those little vulnerabilities, those failures, because that's where other people, and I think it gets back to that idea of like laughter through in those dark moments where it goes like, yeah, I need to connect to somebody, we need to acknowledge and recognize those moments as well. We cannot just be always perfect, so otherwise people don't see us as human. We need to be able to bring all of ourselves to those moments.
I'm wondering for our listeners, you know, we do have listeners who are waiting for an organ right now, or, you know, people who love somebody who's waiting for an organ. And that can be a really struggling time to be in, and it can be really stressful. And, you know, you're facing death, really. I'm wondering, you know, if you have any small improv exercises or anything inspired that maybe you use on a day-to-day basis that people listening could try at home to try to reconnect with that vulnerability or that joy or that present moment that they're in.
I'm sure there in improv there is a lot of games and exercises. They generally involve having a teammate. Because in improv, it's a collaborative exercise. It's a social exercise. It's a way to share something with somebody else. But a lot of those games, they let go of the idea of perfection. And oftentimes, to be playing with control, like the idea that so often in life, we don't have control and we're trying to make things perfect and make things great. There's a game that I'll play with my nieces and nephews and other people in my life where two people, it's called Mind Meld, and two people stand across from each other or sit across from each other, and they each say a word at the same time, and then they try to say a word that connects those two words. So they'll count 1, 2, 3 and they'll each say their new word that connects the previous two words, and the hope is to eventually say the same word at the same time. The issue that happens is a lot of times people are looking for the correct word. They're looking for the right word. But the right word is what the other person might say as well. So nobody has any control of winning the game. It's never, if I just think a little harder, then I can make this game a success. We really have to let go of our control of making this game good or making this game have a successful conclusion, and just be there with another person. And I mean, sometimes I play with my niece and it goes on for a long, long time.
Right.
Because people's brains work in different ways, and it's very enjoyable and entertaining. But I know even in those moments when I'm playing with her, my brain is going, I want to make sure this end result is positive, and I'm going to work so hard for it, but that's not under my control. It's not for me to do. All I can do is be present, be here, put forward what is coming to my brain, and then that will take us one step closer and one step closer and one step closer, and eventually we'll get to the result. And hopefully it's the same word at the same time. Sometimes it's 20 minutes later and we have to leave.
right, yeah, but you had fun for those 20 minutes.
Yeah, but I also, it is a very, I watch people do it, and for some people it really is very difficult to let go of the control of being able to make something go well, to make something be correct. There are other games as well, one word storytelling, where each person adds the next word, and you see people wanting to say two or three or four words because they want to control the story, make it make sense, make it, you know, have the syntax work. Mm-hmm. But the letting go of that control can be very difficult.
Yes. I have actually played that game. I've tried that one word story game in the car with my husband and my 4-year-old. And the way that our brains work as 40-year-old humans is very different than how a 4-year-old's brain works. So you think the next word might be the or and or, you know, something easy, and it ends up being, you know, cupcake or turtle. And you're like, what is going on in this kid's head, right? But it creates so much laughter in the car and so much silliness. And instead of us focusing on the drive ahead, we're laughing and having so much fun about this insane story that makes no sense between the three of us, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's so much more enjoyable to see what someone else's brain will do with your offer than it is to control. In improv, sometimes it happens where people, they really want everyone to be doing the thing that they put out there, and they don't want to let go of that because control feels safe. And like, I know how my brain works. I know the way that my brain will catastrophize. It will create stories in this way and that way. But when I allow somebody else's brain to free me from my routine, suddenly I'm in a much better space. And it's when I let go of that control and just, we call it follow the follower, where we're both just allowing the choices to take us where they take us instead of controlling it, it ends up being much more enjoyable.
Yes. I find that often with conversations, you know, if you're at a group setting, like you're at a social event, you know, I find that once in a while you have somebody in the group and you can tell that they have a prescribed thing that they want to talk about, and they want the whole group to, you know, be part of that whatever topic that is there. And then, you know, maybe other people are coming in with other stories, and sometimes you have a person who keeps trying to bring it back to that one thing, and eventually you're kind of like, what is happening here? And, you know, I really like that idea of, you know, how do we switch that control off and accept the offer from somebody else? Because you're right, it's much more enjoyable and interesting to let it flow and go where life takes us. But, you know, having that control is a place of safety for a lot of people. And it must be interesting watching your class from, you know, the first 5 minutes of day one to, you know, the end of class on week 6 or whenever it is, let go of that control and make that shift.
Yeah, I think oftentimes we talk about in class the difference between yes and no but. And no but is oftentimes also called compromise, where one person says what they want or what they think or what it is that they need to happen. And the other person says no to that, but they offer something that, you know, might not be what they want, but somewhere in the middle ground. And the other person says no, but what about this? And eventually they have one answer, but it's nobody's first answer. And it's one person's answer being taken by the other person. And we call that no, but what about this? And in improv, we yes and, where somebody gives an offer and it's not the offer I would ever do or say. It might be coming from a 4-year-old in the backseat of a car.
Yes.
But I still say, yes, absolutely, that is the answer. But not only that, I'm not just going to say yes to your answer. I'm going to bring myself to it as well. I'm going to bring as much of myself to it as possible. And even if I didn't understand the first offer or didn't like it, if I bring myself, I'll find something I love about it. Mm-hmm. If I add fully and like truthfully of myself to someone else's idea, I will find something that I enjoy about the other person's idea, that I love about it, and be able to continue on in that way. Yes, and can be very vulnerable.
I love that. One more question for you, and this is a biggie. What do you hope the future of drama therapy and, you know, improv and comedic healing looks like in this world that, you know, can often be really serious and really heavy and sometimes scary for everyone?
Yeah, I think like one thing is what I mentioned before, the idea that like joy is healing and laughter is healing. It can also lead to growth. It's not just pain, and that can help somebody grow or become who they are. We need to give acknowledgement and recognition to those positive moments as well. I love the idea of theater being used for positivity and for growth and for healing. I think so often high school, like drama clubs, like oftentimes these things are meant, they get taken so seriously for skill building, and there are much fewer students that are going to become professional actors and actresses than there are students who need the theater to benefit them socially, mentally, psychologically, all of these things. And I think oftentimes people's interactions with the theater or with drama are very skill-based. It's very like, it needs to be a production. The show needs to look like this. For all of those people's interactions with theater, if the focus can be put on the growth and not on the final product, the way it could free and help so many people would be, to me, such a beneficial thing for the world in general.
That's amazing. I love that. I feel the exact same way. I am far out from high school, but I actually still stay in contact with my improv group from high school and my improv teacher, because those are the people who did help, you know, bring that joy and that light into my life and feel more like myself rather than making me feel like I had to be a certain version of me or, you know, do certain things. It really lightened who I was and brought that kind of idea that you're right, you know, joy is healing. We should be relying on these feelings and pulling them back in ourselves when we are in dark times, remembering those really joyful moments and using them for ourselves. So I'm so happy we had this conversation today. I don't think I've smiled this much in a podcast interview in a while. So it was really, really nice to talk about joy and, you know, improv and theater, because it's such a wonderful discussion to have.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I also love this type of work so much. I love the ability to see people in that improv world and know that it's not just people who want to perform improv, but people are doing it for so many different reasons, and we're all just trying to get better at something, to try to grow in some way, to alleviate some pain or some suffering, and can be such a joyful thing.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Yeti. We really appreciate you being here today, and we'll definitely link some resources for people as well if they want to learn more about improv for anxiety.
Thank you so much.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Living Transplant Podcast. If you did, please rate, leave us a review, and share with your friends. Don't forget to subscribe to Living Transplant wherever you're listening today. If you have any ideas for podcast episodes, please reach out to us at livingorgandonation@uhn.ca. For information about living organ donation, you can visit us at www.livingorgandonation.ca. Special thanks to Bespoke Productions for editing this episode and for production support. I'm your host, Candace Coughlin. Thanks for spending your time with us.